I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont is justly proud of its craft brewers and craft distilleries. Last week, Hill Farmstead was just voted best brewery in the world for the fifth year in a row by the online publication Rate Beer. A few years ago, Condé Nast Traveler featured Vermont's beer trail in its magazine, touting how many great breweries you could pop into in just a weekend visit to the state. From cider to beer to gin and vodka and liqueurs to red wine, white wine, and ice wine, Vermont has positioned itself as a destination for discerning drinkers. But it's also a home to a lot of excessive drinkers. Vermont is 12th worst when it comes to excessive drinking. We have the 17th highest rate of alcohol-related driving deaths. And even if we take a step back and just look at alcohol consumption, not necessarily classified as excessive, we're really high. I spent some time this morning poring over a fascinating report from the National Institutes of Health that looks at drinking trends around the country going back through even before Prohibition. It's a little complicated because they actually calculate the amount of ethanol people are drinking, and pure ethanol is a fairly small amount of most alcoholic drinks. So I'm not going to go into the details about gallons of ethanol versus gallons of liquid Americans are drinking, but the big takeaway is that alcohol consumption is on the rise around the country, and Vermont consumption is well above average. Okay, actually, I do need to get into the ethanol thing for just a minute here. The statistics calculate how much ethanol is being consumed by the population of people aged 14 and older in each state. On average, Americans drink 2.35 gallons of ethanol a year. NIH wants people to drink no more than 2.1 gallons of ethanol a year. I know that sounds confusing, but they actually helpfully offer an idea of how many standard drinks that would be. About 448. So the NIH is hoping we can lower our alcohol consumption to average 448 drinks a year. Sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Vermont is actually way above that average. We consume over 3 gallons of ethanol per year, per person over the age of 14. And let's hope not all of our 14-year-olds are drinking 500 or 600 drinks a year. We know they're not, but we do have a high rate of teen drinking. All of this to say, we struggle to balance our pride over our craft booze with our healthy outlook and need to model appropriate drinking behavior. Is there any way to actually achieve that balance? Can we be healthy drinkers? What would that look like as a state? We're going to explore those concepts today, and I'm joined first by two people who have to think about that modeling behavior in many aspects of their lives. Sass Stewart is co-founder of Stonecutter Spirits in Middlebury. Sass, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
And Tiffany Shemazik is an account manager for the Vermont Wine Merchants Company. Tiffany, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
So within the industry, the alcohol-related industry, this must be a big issue, whether it's talked about or not. I mean, you're in the business of booze, and you're also in the business of having to drink. Many of you, if not most of you, drink for a living, talk about drinks for a living, talk about how to mix drinks for a living, talk about the value of this drink over that drink, you know, this brand over that brand. And Sass, you've actually talked about how your job does involve this level of drinking and sort of paying attention to alcohol, and yet you do think about moderation and healthy drinking a lot. So can you talk a little bit about how you conceive of this topic?
Yeah. I mean, this is something we talk a lot about at Stonecutter as a concept, as well as I talk about in my own personal life and professional life, my relationship with alcohol. Because like Tiffany, you know, we are, like you said, in the business of thinking and drinking a lot. And for me, it's really about mindfulness. And when I think about drinking, I think about an experience. And that experience is what is in my glass. And I've been known to just flat out refuse to finish drinking something because I didn't enjoy it. And I think that mindfulness over like what the experience of what's in your glass is really, really important. And it's the first step to having a broader conversation about what does it mean, you know, to invite something into your body. I make things that I want you to invite into your body. And so I need to be really thoughtful about the creation of those and the application of those.
And I understand that, Tiffany, you and Sass have actually talked about this together. You have sort of personal conversations about this topic. So bring that conversation out into the open. How do you discuss this?
Well, we were actually just talking on Thursday, which is how we got around to this show and the topic. Like Sass mentioned, my colleagues and other acquaintances and myself constantly have this conversation. And I do think it's important to be aware, because not only do we want to promote what we're representing, but we also want to do it in a conscious fashion. No industry professional that I know promotes binge drinking. It's more about honoring the craft that's in the glass, whether it's something Sass makes or these amazing breweries we have, or wine from my portfolio. So it's really about honoring what the craft and what's in the glass.
Is it possible to do that, though, with an eye on the bottom line, when you're both involved in an industry that requires people to drink, and the more they drink, the more money you make? And we're in a state where people drink a lot. So, I mean, that's good for your business if people drink a lot. It's not necessarily good for them, and it's not necessarily good for some aspects of the state economy or the state's healthcare picture. So, I mean, you know, you're in an industry that's asking people to drink, and them drinking a lot is good for your bottom line, Sass.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to bring up, right? So if you're just thinking about the bottom line and the point that we have this booming, wonderful industry, the fact of the matter is my bottom line is not just in Vermont. My bottom line is in Massachusetts, and it's in New York, and a lot of my colleagues in beer, wine, cider, and spirits, we sell here, and this is our home state. This is where we love. This is our backyard, and we worship it. If we want to continue employing, like Stonecutter, 20-plus people, I need to make sure that my product gets spread around. But beyond that, right, the idea of having a substance that you are promoting for anything, I think it's really about that balance, right? So I do want you to have Stonecutter gin and whiskey in your drinks, right? Like, that's why I made it, right, in the first place. Beyond the fact that I am able to, like, pay for my apartment and cat food, you know, I also really, like, I love what I make, and I want to spread that. And I talk a lot about the defense of the mocktail, which is the opposite of what I make. It is something that is a mock cocktail, so it's something made with lots of delicious ingredients, hopefully, but is something that does not contain any alcoholic ingredients. And I like that for three different reasons. One, it is a great way to spend more time socially. I think one of the greatest things about alcohol in general, and beer and wine and spirits, it's meant to be shared, right? These are things that we are usually consuming in the company of other people. And if you are able to expand that experience and that time that you're out, that means more experience you get to have with other people. And I think that's what community is about. And so if you have a drink in between that allows you to, like, refresh a little bit, it actually allows you to stay out a little bit longer, which comes in the second point, which means you could have another drink because your body has had time to process that first one so that you have time enough, you can have another one. And it's really safe, and it's not destructive, and it's a healthy way to enjoy alcohol. And I don't know, I think the more that we can practice those kinds of behaviors and model them, like you said, the stronger we are as a community. Because alcohol is a really important piece of our social toolkit for dealing with a lot of things. And I think that booze and even other substances, they help people deal with anxiety. They help people deal with depression. There's nothing wrong with those things. It's if they are any one thing is used in excess, that's when it starts to become troubling.
We're talking today about drinking culture in Vermont. And, you know, we know that Vermonters on average drink more than the national average, and that there's a lot of unhealthy drinking going on. And yet we're a state that really prides itself on craft breweries, craft distilleries. You know, how do we square that? How do we be a place that has both of those things together? And can it be done in a healthy way? And what would that sort of statewide modeling look like? And we're getting some interesting emails from people and notes coming in before the show. One listener wrote in to say, before moving to southern Vermont in 2011, I lived for nearly 15 years in two large cities with 24-hour public transportation and extensive taxi fleets. And I worked at bars, mixing drinks and pulling beers. Only once did I confiscate someone's car keys. Everyone else had other plans for getting home. When I first moved here, I was alarmed by how many people I saw drinking out at night and then getting behind the wheel to go home. Now, with two little kids, I've been to multiple daytime kids' birthday parties where the parents throwing the parties were really pushing beer or wine on their guests, knowing full well that every person there had at least a 10-mile drive to get home, most of them much longer. My question is, given that no amount of alcohol is really safe for driving, and given that Vermont, for better or for worse, is a state of drivers, what can really be done to change a culture that permits and even encourages people to have a couple of drinks and then get behind the wheel? Vermont will continue to produce fantastic beers and spirits, and Vermonters will continue to drink them. So how can we square that with basic safety? Tiffany, what do you think?
That is a tough dichotomy in this state for sure. And again, it's something that my friends and I think about often. As of late, I've had more dialogue with my friends about who is going to be the designated driver, and that really somebody has to step up. Fortunately, I live in the greater Burlington area where Uber and Lyft exists. So I kind of feel like I just have that at just a quick couple buttons. But most of the state is rural. So I cannot encourage enough. It sounds a little cliche, but I really can't encourage enough to figure that out, sort that out. I think a person in your party has to decide to have a mocktail, like at Stonecutters, sip on some seltzer. I just think that responsibility trumps everything else.
And Sass, I mean, we know that drinking and driving often do go hand in hand for whatever the laws say. And we've done shows about that in the past, too. Why do we have this culture that people think it's okay to drink and drive? Because, you know, you can just look at the police reports to see how often people are being arrested for DUIs. And, you know, we just experienced Super Bowl Sunday. We know a lot of people get on the road toasted or drunk after watching the game. So you were talking about the importance of alcohol in our culture in terms of a social lubricant or a way for people to come together and socialize. So how do we square that with drinking and driving?
I mean, like Tiffany said, this is a conversation that comes up all the time. I know the way that we do things for Stonecutter, like we just participated in Hotel Vermont's Ice Bar this last weekend, and we knew a lot of our staff was going to want to go out afterwards. We got a hotel room and made sure that anyone who didn't want to drive all the way home, I live in Virgins, you know, I'm doing that commute quite a bit. I know it's a pain just to do it late at night after having worked all day, let alone if you've had a few drinks.
That's about a 45-minute drive. Virgins is in Addison County.
Yeah, it's about... I say 35 because I like to really at least psych myself out on that. But I agree with Tiffany. I think that conversation around ownership is really important. But I also think there's this other part where it's one of the things I love about the mocktail, not to bring it up again. But I want to – if I'm the designated driver and I'm happy to be, I want to have something delicious to drink. I still want to go out and enjoy myself. And I think that there's something to be said for – having those options available culturally for us, and that it's not just a seltzer or it's not a Shirley Temple, which is really, really sweet. And that's not my jam. And honestly, I think it's less and less in vogue for those really, really super sweet drinks. To have those things available within our industry, within our restaurant and bar industry, that those things are out there, that they're promoted. You know, at Highball Social, our new tasting room, we have a mocktail section on every menu. It has a header. You know, we're being really conscious and decisive about saying this is a non-alcoholic option. Or maybe you just don't drink, but you want to go out with a friend who does drink. There should be options there for people to engage with those social parts of drinking, but not the alcoholic parts of drinking.
Although I will say, I mean, that still seems fairly rare. I read an article like 6 or 7 years ago that was saying, you know, all of the sort of big urban environments like New York City and L.A., the mocktails are in. Everybody's creating these really great craft drinks that have no alcohol. And I was like, great. Can't wait to go out
in Vermont. Now.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's still a challenge to find somebody who can make you something sophisticated that doesn't have alcohol. And they, you know, when I ask for that, they look at me like, what are you talking about? You know, we can give you ginger ale. It's like, but come on, where's the sage? Where's the like infused syrup that has something really interesting? And it's, I mean, you may have it, but it's not, it doesn't seem like that's like the mocktail has infused the drinking culture in Vermont.
It's getting more. I mean, I agree. We're not like at 100% saturation rate. But I hope that the more we can have these conversations around the importance of it, it's not seen as this lower value item. It's more seen as a tool on a menu to help people engage with your space, right? So even from a business owner's perspective, I think it's fabulous. I have a lot of friends who are pregnant who want to go out and enjoy things. They're going to come to my business, right? They're going to be a part of my community. And I think the more I can model that, and the way Tiffany models things like this too, the more hopefully we can have that larger impact and show that like there's even economic incentive besides the obvious social incentive for offering these kinds of options.
We're talking again about Vermont's drinking culture and how we elevate drinking in our state. We're also very proud of being a very healthy state, but our drinking levels suggest significant excess. So what would a healthy balance look like? Can the state actually promote craft brewers, distilleries, and wineries with a straight face while also addressing health effects of high levels of unhealthy drinking? We got a note from Julie who says, I'm frustrated by the surge in craft-style breweries in our state. And while, of course, I know they help support the economy and are often more socially and environmentally conscious about their impact, I'm worried about how these craft, hipster, local beers and ciders seem to sanitize the fact that alcohol is alcohol, no matter how it's packaged. The impact on the body and brain is the same whether you're drinking a cheap American beer or spending a lot more on a local craft beer. Wouldn't it be interesting to have a debate about whether the manufacturers of alcoholic beverages have an ethical and or moral responsibility to provide more education about addiction and to contribute to addiction treatment programs and services throughout our Vermont communities? John in Montpelier says, as a cyclist who logs thousands of miles on Vermont's paved and dirt roads, the proliferation of boutique brewery and liquor tasting rooms, particularly in rural areas and small towns, is an emerging threat to my life and other road users. By encouraging beer and liquor tasting in places where it is implicit that visitors will be driving their own personal cars, these companies are inadvertently threatening the lives of motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians. Today we're talking with Sass Stewart, co-founder of Stonecutter Spirits in Middlebury, and Tiffany Shimazik, account manager for the Vermont Wine Merchants Company. Yes, they both work in the business of alcohol, but that's actually partly why we wanted to have them on today, because they are two people within the industry who think a lot about the potential for healthy drinking, drinking in moderation, what it looks like to promote alcohol and to promote healthy behaviors. We know that for many people, there is no level of drinking that's healthy or sustainable. But this conversation is less specifically about alcoholism personally and more about how we live in a culture that celebrates drinking while also having to deal with those many detrimental effects of unhealthy levels of drinking. So what should we do about that and how do we conceive of it in our own lives? Elaine is calling in from Winooski. Hi, Elaine. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that that this is a much broader problem, and I think it's really across many socio and economic and cultural parts of Vermont. I remember when I lived in Lamoille County and then up in the Northeast Kingdom, a common antidote was a six-pack on the dash, four on the floor, and a can in your hand. And so I think that the amount of people that are consuming alcohol, not at breweries or wineries or in bars, is higher than people think of buying their six pack on Friday night and buying one on Saturday and Sunday. And I just think that we're neglecting, if we're looking at alcohol consumption, we're neglecting our cultural part of drinking beer or the cultural part of the Vermont, which has been around a long time.
Elaine, thanks. I appreciate your perspective here. Appreciate you sharing it and would love to bring Tiffany and Sass in here to talk about that. So, Tiffany, what do you think? I mean, here's Elaine talking about the actual way people drink is maybe different than what we promote in this state and what Sass has been talking about, especially with this idea of, you know, sort of conversation and culture and moderate drinking.
Right. I think what Elaine is highlighting is kind of the opposite of what we've talked about thus far in the show, which is we're really talking about tasting rooms and craft breweries, et cetera. And what I believe she's talking about is living in a rural town, getting home from work on a Friday and drinking on the way home. And I planned on really only speaking from my experience and my environment while I was here on the show. I can only suspect perhaps it's boredom, lack of access to a recreation where drinking is the focal point in maybe some of these rural towns. But Sass,
I don't know. I mean, I live in a rural town.
Right.
But if I want to be somebody who's being a drinker who has more than one drink, mm-hmm. I don't want to be somebody who's then driving. So that then requires me to be drinking somewhere where either I have a designated driver or I'm in a place where I don't have to drive. So, you know, there might be a night where my husband and I have two or three drinks and we're just at home by ourselves. But that seems like a healthier choice or at least a safer choice than going out on the roads. And it's not necessarily boredom, but it's like, are we going to drive 20 minutes to a restaurant?
Right.
Or, you know, can we have our nice dinner at home and a bottle of wine or a couple of beers?
Well, that's just speculation for me. That seemed to be what your caller was stating. It could be just an access to maybe a 12 pack that costs, I don't know, $6, $7, $8. You know, kind of like quantity over quality. But maybe Sass can chime in too, since she's a maker.
Well, I would say just cross the board. It doesn't really matter what you're putting in there. No one here condones drinking while driving.
No.
I think that's like a straight up, don't do that. It doesn't matter what is in the six pack or if it's a bottle of wine or if it's a bottle of Stoker. Don't do that. That's a terrible, terrible idea. But I do think that there's the cultural reference is really interesting. And I think what Elaine was touching on is actually more kind of problematic drinking, not about who's drinking it or what they're drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think culturally what Tiffany and I are kind of alluding to is wanting to shift a culture through the act of making high quality spirits, cider, wine, beer. And you're seeing more of it because there's an increasing appreciation for who makes it, what ingredients they're using, what are their methods, what are the flavors they're creating. And I think the appreciation of that is where I want to see everything heading, right? So there's no point for me to make a gin or any kinds of whiskey that someone else makes, right? I want to do something different. And to your point, the email I think we got earlier that was saying, you know, alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. Alcohol is not all alcohol. And the way you manufacture things is really important as to what you put in someone's, what you're inviting someone to put in their body. So a shot of vodka that comes out of a plastic jug is different than a shot of Smuggler's Notch vodka. Those are actually not the same thing because when you break it down chemically, so I can get really nerdy about distillation here, but the way that you distill things, if you're doing it right and you're doing it thoughtfully, is that you're cutting out a lot of the ethanol pieces that are impure or can give bad taste. And if you're trying to make a cheaper product, you keep them in. So that means you're also then taking those pieces into your body as well. And that's the same of cheap beer. That's same, you know, things are made cheaply. They're made with cheaper ingredients. And then you're putting those in your body. And so alcohol isn't alcohol, even though a 6% might be a 6%. The way it actually affects your body can be totally different.
You know, one of the interesting things that I read about in preparation for this show was that actually the states that have the higher median incomes often have higher rates of excessive drinking. And I mean, this is, I know we can get into that question of correlation and causation, and we don't know whether people of higher income levels are drinking products that are higher end or not. But it was interesting to see that states that typically have higher levels of income often also have higher levels of excessive drinking. So it may be because, you know, you can afford booze, you're actually buying more of it, or, you know, you are going out and having a couple of cocktails when you're out to dinner because, you know, you can afford two or three $12 cocktails. It was just interesting to see. Let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to endorse something that I have. I used to be a problem drinker, and Vermont state law was changed to allow for an ignition intercept device, which I've had installed because I sort of lost confidence in my own judgment, and it prevents me from starting my car when I have blood alcohol content above a certain level, and you can have them set, the intercept set to different levels to prevent the possibility of driving while you're impaired or at least inebriated.
Yeah, Bill, that's such an interesting idea and an interesting way to look at it. And I remember hearing a couple years ago as well a show, I think On Point was doing it, about should we lower the the alcohol limit at which you're allowed to drive from 0.08 to something like 0.03, something that would, you know, not get you in trouble if you'd had cough syrup or something, but that would basically say, like, yeah, you can't drink and then drive, because 0.08 is so difficult for so many people to calculate. And, you know, we probably shouldn't be just calculating based on, like, what is the exact limit at which I can drive. But for many people, it's based on how much you've been eating, how tired you are, what you weigh, what your gender is. You know, there are a lot of different factors that go into it. So maybe having a device that actually helps you understand, you know, what your blood alcohol is and how you feel would be an interesting way to look at this issue. Jose is calling in from Barnett. Hi, Jose. Go right ahead.
Hi. Just calling because I find it interesting that, you know, I guess I espouse the idea that, you know, alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. The quality of it, I'm sure, you know, you can go to great lengths to speak of, you know, some is made better than others. But some people who drink turpentine, you know, they'll drink anything. Why? Because they like the effect, the buzz. That hasn't gone anywhere. You can gloss it over. You know, you can create certain drinks that are, that are non-drinks. You know, bravo. I love it. But that's not what's out there. And the alcohol industry is super powerful and working with a population that needs that self, you know, medication. And that's not going to go away.
Yeah, Jose. Yeah, I appreciate that perspective. Sass, you wanted to chime in on that?
Yeah. I think, again, we're touching on some stuff that is very important in our culture, and things about when people have health problems. Alcoholism it's a health problem. And I think it's a very important thing to talk about. When I think about even having kind of the constructs on your car to keep you from driving, those are really interesting tools, right, to deal with symptoms. But I think we want to talk about the first part, right, where we're starting, which is what is our culture around drinking? And yes, someone would drink whatever if they have a problem with alcohol. But that's also kind of not what we're talking about entirely, right? I think it's really interesting to engage Vermont as a manufacturer of all these different things, where our responsibility lies. And I think our responsibility lies in many ways with our own modeling of that behavior. And I think that there's this idea that we should lower the drinking age,
blood alcohol limit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really not going to even get to the core, right? It's really about demystifying and creating transparency around alcohol and how it affects humans. Right? We all have different ways it affects us. Like you said, it's sex, it's gender, or those are the same thing. It's how much I weigh, what I ate, what I did today. And it's more, I think if we can encourage people to be more engaged with how things affect them, that the stronger we are as a culture. And that's true for all kinds of things. When we keep things away from people, they want them more, right? So we have a drinking age that's 21. I'm not advocating changing that. But I am advocating the idea that we don't keep it in a closet locked away from people, that it is part of our culture. We do cherish this. We use it to celebrate people. We use it when things are terrible. We commiserate over a glass of wine. It's not a bad thing. It really is this part of a larger toolkit. Like if I get done at the end of a long day and it was stressful, I can go for a walk, or I can pour a glass of wine, or I can do any number of things to de-stress from my day. And if I choose alcohol or if I don't choose alcohol, it's based on what I think is best for my body and my mind. And I think the more we could think about it that way, the stronger we'll be.
Well, it's interesting. We're hearing from a lot of different people on a lot of different aspects of this, and some, you know, pushing back. Jared says, I'm concerned with Sass's implication that alcohol is an appropriate way to treat anxiety and depression. I'm a mental health counselor, and I spend quite a bit of my professional time encouraging other coping strategies that have less potential harmful effects. Bill in Grand Isle wants to have a little bit more balance in the messages and writes, there are many more messages to people of all ages, including children and youth, about the pleasure, joy, and normalcy of consuming alcohol to facilitate socialization, relaxation, and the pleasure of living. There are too few messages providing factual information about the negative impact of consuming alcohol on the functioning of the brain and responsible behavior of all peoples, regardless of age, education, or income. Sean says, how much of this should be considered a socioeconomic issue? Are rich people getting drunk more often than poor people in Vermont? Do they have more money to spend on booze? Do they have more emotional weight to carry? And Sean, I don't have those statistics. I think they are out there, and we could look at the socioeconomic impact of drinking, and definitely didn't mean to imply that that's necessarily the case in Vermont. But it's interesting to think about sort of class and drinking. And Mary says, I think that the craft brewers and distillers are a plus to the state, and the customers drinking on site, of course, should be monitored for safe consumption and driving. The serious problem is driving while drinking alcohol purchased at convenience stores and gas stations. I walk the roads locally and see the alcohol containers that are tossed out of cars and trucks. They are not bottles from craft brewers, but cans of inexpensive national brands of beer, juice box style packages of wine, large cans of malt liquor that are purchased for drinking on the way home from work or for just driving around on a weekend. Mark says, at what point does the emergence of a successful marketable industry bring in more trouble than it's worth to Vermont? That seems to be the question being asked during the show today. We want successful businesses in Vermont that bring in tourist dollars and commerce, right? Would Vermont be better off if these breweries and distilleries never opened in Vermont? At some point, a business is bound to consider the ethics of its operation and how it fits into society in general. But this show just seems to be about Vermont biting the hand that feeds it. Let's take another guest here. Rick Barnett is a clinical psychologist and addiction specialist in private practice in Stowe and is on the line with us now. Hi, Rick.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Well, thanks. So, you know, where do you come into this conversation when you talk to people, sometimes about addiction, but also about healthy drinking behavior?
Well, it's really interesting because everything that's being talked about in the show is really spot on, and I really endorse some of the things that your guests are saying about, you know, not demonizing alcohol. But there is a real job that we all have to do, like some of your guests have said, about being super, super mindful about our own personal choices. And I think our judgment can get clouded sometimes when there is all this messaging about the social acceptability of drinking in our culture. You know, I grew up in a town called Stowe, as some people know, and there's a famous bar there called the Matterhorn, and there's a T-shirt that they have saying that, you know, Stowe is not a skiing town with a drinking problem, it's a drinking town with a skiing problem. And, you know, in a town like Stowe and some other places, it is really normalized, and there are some serious problems with it, and people don't actually realize how they're being scripted or programmed to gravitate and socialize around alcohol, around all kinds of activities, whether it's running races or mountain biking and having a beer afterwards. And a lot of that is normal and healthy, and I totally support that. But if we don't pay attention to our own personal choices, we lose sight of when unhealthy drinking comes into play and all kinds of problems ensue. So I really appreciate this program. It's spot on.
Well, Rick, thanks very much. Appreciate your perspective as well. Rick Barnett is a clinical psychologist and an addiction specialist in Stowe. Interesting to bring in here, you know, the way we talk and think about liquor and alcohol. And, you know, Tiffany, I want to give you just one more chance here before we end to, you know, how should we be thinking and talking? Because you and Sass do have this conversation together. We don't all have conversations with our friends about what healthy drinking looks like. So should we be? I mean, should we be talking to our friends about that as we sip a cocktail over dinner?
I think so. Absolutely. I mean, I've been surrounded by restaurant industry professionals for 15 years. So it's second nature that I'm having conversations like this all of the time. Ultimately, I want balance in my life. And so I often talk about how do we balance out tasting, drinking, socializing with maybe something more active, more stimulating, both physically and mentally. And I think that's really important to do. At least personally, that's what I strive to do every day. So I think that being aware, and I'm an advocate of personal choice, as well as promoting really great products. So it goes hand in hand, I think.
Sass?
I mean, I think the more mindful we can be about what we're putting in our bodies, the better across the board. Alcohol is just one of those things that we also need to be thoughtful about. I think, you know, without opening can of worms, there's lots of things that we can do and consume that we should be really, really thoughtful about. And the more that we can model that behavior as professionals, I mean, I got to say, there's no one I know in the craft spirits, beer, cider, wine world that doesn't think and talk about this a lot, especially with our staff and especially with our colleagues. And the more we can bridge that conversation out and start modeling that behavior so that you can see what healthy drinking looks like. You know, if I'm out late at a lot of accounts or things like that, I'm not party girl. I'm a business owner, and I'm doing that as part of my business. And so just to shift some of those perceptions around what alcohol is and what it has to mean to people, I think we can be more embracing, more transparent, and more communal about it.
That's Sass Stewart, co-founder of Stonecutter Spirits in Middlebury, and Tiffany Shemazik, an account manager for the Vermont Wine Merchants Company. Thanks very much to both of you for having this conversation with us today.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you very much.